Please join me in welcoming Dr. David Dunning.
Well, thank you, and thank you for spending a little bit of your evening this evening in my world. First announcement I have to make is I have no forms for you to fill out. I feel bereft. But I also want to thank the library system for allowing for this forum where we can come and tell the stories of the research we do and what sort of knowledge we produce in our laboratories. But I guess what I'd like to start off with today is to take us on a little bit of a trip. I'd like to start us off by imagining that you're just outside the village of Nemcha in Nepal, looking up at the mountain that the Nepalese refer to as Sagarmatha, the forehead of Earth. Now, when the British came to South Asia, they loved to measure things, and they measured Sagarmatha and realized it was over 8,000 meters tall. In fact, it was the tallest mountain they'd ever seen. Turns out to be the tallest mountain that anyone has ever seen. We will tend to know it by its British name. Actually, it should be a Welsh name, but that's another story. By its British name of Mount Everest. Now, in anything since the time of its measurement, Mount Everest has just been more and more of an object of obsession. People love to climb it. In fact, there'll be several hundred people next month trying to summit Mount Everest. But if there's one thing you're going to do, if you're going to take this on as a task, you really need to know yourself. You really need to know your mountaineering skills. You need to know your physical capabilities. And you need to know your mental willpower. You need to know if you can cross these rickety ladder bridges that go from crevice to crevice in the Kumba ice flow while you're wearing full mountain gear, for example. You need to know if you can survive the climb up to Camp 4 in the death zone, because no rescue helicopter can reach that high. And then on the day you summit, you have to know if you can get up early in the morning while it's still dark, climb the last 3,000 vertical feet you have to go, not taking in too much of the oxygen that you've been given, because no one can carry enough oxygen to really make it a comfortable trip. You have to know if you can negotiate the Hillary Step, which is a vertical climb that you have to do within 200 feet of the summit. And then finally, you have to know that if you're not in range of making the summit by 1 or 2 p.m., that you have to turn around, even after months of preparations and thousands of dollars in doing this. Now, this is no luxury, this knowing yourself. There have been, if I have the number right, 4,469 people who have successfully summited Mount Everest since the 1950s. But there have been 287 people who have died, either on the way up or either on the way down. And if you do the math, that's one out of every 17 people. So this is something that you really do have to know. Now, this may be true for climbing Mount Everest, but I would suggest that knowing yourself, knowing your capabilities, knowing your competencies, knowing your character, knowing what influences you and what can't influence you, knowing what you're capable of, is something that's important for any of the small summits that we might be trying to negotiate in our everyday life, whether it be just making it through a career successfully or raising wonderful kids or trying to figure out who to vote for in a presidential election. That is, we all face summits that we have to get through in our everyday, and the question is, to what extent do we know what we should know, especially about ourselves, when we try to achieve these tasks successfully? Now, what I'm here tonight to report is, if you take a look at the psychological literature, what you find is a literature that is a little bit complicated and is a little bit of a cautionary tale. Because if you take a look at what people have said through the centuries about this task of knowing yourself, knowing what you're capable of, knowing what you're not capable of, Ben Franklin mentioned that there are three things that are extremely hard: diamonds, steel, and to know oneself. And the British adventurer Beryl Markham once remarked that you can live a lifetime and at the end of it know more about other people than you can know about yourself. Now, that seems to be a little bit dour message about our ability to know ourselves. After all, if you go back to the Greeks thought there was nothing that was a more of an important task than knowing yourself. They even inscribed it at the Oracles of Delphi. It was one of the few clear things you could get out of the Oracle of Delphi. Was the inscription, "Know thyself." Several commentators, philosophers, social observers through the centuries have said there is nothing more important than the accurate study of man and woman, for example, to know who you are. But what I want to suggest tonight is that there are certain complications in the task, certain barriers in the task, certain surprises in the task of knowing yourself, and I want to share with you a little bit of those surprises today, so that maybe we can also talk about how do you achieve this ultimate goal that the Greeks set for us way back in the days of antiquity. Now, let me tell you a little bit of what I do. I'm a social psychologist. I mainly work in the psychology lab. And what I do is I play a little bit, if you know anything about science fiction movies from the 90s, I play a little bit of Neo in my work. That is, if people are familiar with the science fiction movie The Matrix, The Matrix took place in a fantasy world that computers had generated for its subjects who served as batteries, and so they believed that they lived in an amazing, interesting, and complex urban world of the late 20th century. That's where they believed they were, when in fact the reality was far, far different. Now, I'm not going to tell you that we're all batteries serving computers, but it is the case that you can ask the question, especially if you're a psychologist, how much do we really have an accurate apprehension of the world, of us, and our relationship to the world? So what I do is, Neo once gave the main character in The Matrix a choice. Either he could swallow a red pill and see reality for what it really was, or he could swallow a blue pill and go back to the fantasy, back to the simulation, the hologram, that was more familiar to him. We don't do that. What we do is we basically study people in their blue pill world. That is, what sort of world do they think they live in, and what sort of person do they think they are in that world? And we don't give them occasionally the red pill. What we do is we take the red pill ourselves so that we know what reality is. And what we can do is compare their impressions of themselves, their ideas about themselves, to what we know is ground truth. In this small world, we can actually create ground truth. And what we often find is we often find data like these. Now, we're not the only researchers who do this, so let me just mention some of my favorite findings that have come from other researchers through the years. The basic question being, how well do people know themselves? A lot of this comes from medicine, by the way, because medical students are tested, how shall I say this, up the wazoo. Every time medical students turn around, they're being tested on something. Researchers can take advantage of that. For example, Rasucci in 1989 basically followed a number of residents going through their surgical rotation, and at the end of it basically asked their supervisors, a peer, and the resident themselves to rate their surgical skill. Basically, how good are you at whatever, you know, whatever the sub-skills are in dealing with surgery, and then compared what people said about the resident to their score on the ABSITE, which is the American Board of Surgery's in-training exam, to see to what extent people's beliefs about themselves were related to how they demonstrated performance about themselves, their objective performance. Now, if you take a look at supervisor ratings, what you find is that supervisor ratings are correlated over 0.5. To a psychologist, that's wow. That's in the wow range. Correlated 0.5 with how well the student did on the exam. If you asked a peer about this resident's skill, their ratings correlated around 0.5 with how that person actually did on the ABSITE. So far, so good. There is a signal being sent by the residents about how good or how bad they are in surgical surgical training. What about self-insight? How did it compare? It compared like that. Now, that square does indicate a zero correlation. Here's the good news. It's a plus zero. It is not a negative zero, but basically what this is showing, in a world in which people are sending signals about the quality of their work, and something that I think matters, other people seem to be better to pick up on it than people themselves. Beryl Markham might have been right in her observation that you might know other people more better than you know yourselves. Well, that's one way in which you can study the extent to which we know ourselves. Do impressions of ourselves correlate with objective performance? that we do. There are other things that you can do as well as just see if we get the basic level of our competence right. And another favorite study of mine comes from a teaching hospital in Sydney, Australia. This was done by a research group led by Barnsley, who basically put medical interns through some standard exercises to see how well they could do certain medical procedures like catheterization of a male patient. That's what we're going to be talking about here specifically. These are known as OSCEs for those in the know. And basically what would happen is that the intern would do the exercise, do the OSCE, and while they're being watched by their supervisor, while they're being watched by their teacher. And so they do it, and at the end they'd be asked questions like, do you think you need supervision? The supervisor would be asked, do you think the student still needs supervision in terms of doing this procedure? And in the data they found, none of the students, after they went through this, thought that they needed supervision on male catheterization of a male patient, but 50% of their supervisors thought they still needed supervision. They hadn't got the technique down yet. But if you ask them a second question, do you know this well enough that you can teach this to others? A full 80% of students said that they could teach this to others. They knew the skill that well. None of the supervisors agreed. And this is something, by the way, that you find time and again in the world of do people know themselves. People do tend to be overconfident. Not everybody, not every time for any of us, but in the main what you find is that people are overconfident in what they think they know, what they think they can do, how they think they can perform. Just to give you another example of this, another favorite study done by Zenger in 1992, he surveyed engineers in two software development firms. That you've heard of the firms, but for reasons of research, they're known as Firm A and Firm B. And the engineers were asked to rate their engineering skills vis-a-vis their peers. And in Company A, a full 32% of the engineers thought that their skills placed in the top 5% of the company, which seems like an outrageous number until you find that in Firm B, 42% of the engineers there, almost half, thought their skills placed them in the top 5% of the company. So much for it being lonely at the top, not necessarily the perceptual top. And just one final sneak in of an example, because this happened last month. This is how Americans respond about whether or not they think global warming will harm people in the United States. And brown basically means more than 50% say yes. Blue means less than 50% say yes. So this is a percent of adults. And as you can see, more than 50% of Americans think that global warming will harm people in the United States. Not a surprise. They've heard the message. But what if you ask about them personally? It's almost zero think that global warming is going to harm them. And this somehow cannot be true. Unless everybody's thinking of the Rio Grande Valley, that cannot be true. But this is commonly what you find in data where people rate themselves. People are overconfident. And it's not completely ubiquitous, but it is everywhere that you look. It's something that you often find, and it's so much so that presenting you overconfidence data in a psychology talk is a non-finding circa 2017. Of course, you'd expect people to be overconfident. That's what you always find. And it does have some problems associated with it. You can imagine the surgical case we've just talked about. In fact, Danny Kahneman, the Nobel laureate-winning psychologist, once said that if he had a magic wand, the one problem that he would get rid of is overconfidence. That's the one that he thinks is the most pervasive and the most costly in terms of the world and in terms of potential errors and folly that people might get into. And what it also turns out to be is it turns out to be a major issue or a major problem in knowing yourself. People tend toward the overconfident. And now the question becomes why. Now, in terms of the topic of knowing yourself, there are about 100 different hours of talks I could give in terms of different lessons we learn or different complications we confront whenever we look at people trying to figure out who they are and what they're capable of or what they might be. I only get an hour. Actually, I only get 50 minutes. So I'm only going to talk about a thin sliver of the work that can be done. This is work that can carry many, many psychological researcher careers, and I hope so because the graduate students keep coming. But what I want to basically focus on today is essentially the sliver of this work about knowing yourself, or what are the barriers about to knowing yourself that most people have been asking about for the past year. And some of you may know of it, some of you may not know of it, but it's what everybody's asking about, so that's what I'm going to focus in on, which is basically something known as the Dunning-Kruger effect and its problem in terms of preventing people from really, really knowing themselves. And in particular, it's a sliver of the reason why people tend to be so overconfident. And the basic idea of the Dunning-Kruger effect is that often knowing yourself or judging yourself is a little bit of an irony in the sense that to be able to judge yourself and how expert you are, don't you already need to be an expert? The problem is that a lot of us aren't experts, or if we are experts, there still are gaps or defects in what we know. The question is, how can we judge our own expertise when we, in fact, ourselves are not experts? Doesn't this mean that we're going to make errors? And the answer is yes, and particularly those who have, how shall I say it, severe deficits in their expertise. They don't know much. They have a lot of gaps. They have a lot of defects in what they have, whatever they think it's different from the color of the sky in our world. That is, they think something different. And what the Dunning-Kruger effect basically is for those people, and by the way, those people is all of us sooner or later. What the Dunning-Kruger effect is that poor performers in whatever domain or what area of life you want to talk about cannot recognize their shortcomings in their expertise or gaps in their knowledge. They can't, because to judge expertise, you need expertise. And if you lack expertise, you don't have the skill that you need to be able to recognize that what you're doing are mistakes. Or another way to put it is that those who lack expertise suffer a double burden. The first burden is that they're going to make a lot of mistakes. They're going to make a lot of errors. But the second burden is they're not going to be able to recognize those mistakes as errors, because often recognizing your mistakes requires the exact same skills as making a correct decision in the first place. In order to produce a logically sound argument, you need to know the rules of logic. But if you don't know the rules of logic, you're going to make unsound arguments. But more to the point, you're not going to know that they're unsound. You're not going to be in a position to know that they're unsound. And this is a basic problem that everybody has when they're trying to evaluate themselves. We don't necessarily have the expertise to recognize how little expertise we really have. As a consequence, what happens with poor performers, they choose what they think is the most reasonable. They can't think of anything else that's a more reasonable alternative. So they often think they're doing just fine when they're, in fact, doing very, very badly. And this is something that we've demonstrated in a lot of different ways. Let me just give you the paradigmatic, the typical example of how we study this. And it turns out to be very simple to study. This is a particular study we did at Cornell University, where we just waited for a large lecture psychology class to happen and to have its first exam in the class. And this is a class that had over 200 people in it. And as people left the room, we basically asked people, how well did you do on that exam, period? And did something else, which is we asked for permission to find out their true exam grade. We weren't going to run around and tell everybody their true exam grade, but our research team could find out how well they actually did. And what we simply did is compared how well people thought they did to how well they actually did in the course. And what this graph represents, if I want to make sure I press the right button, because if you're going to talk about incompetence, it is awful to show incompetence. Here we go. What we did is we, based on their actual performance on the test, we split people in the bottom 25% of performers, the second 25%, the third 25%, and finally the top 25%. And this is how well they actually did. We use a percentile score here because Cornell students know what percentile means. But this is how well the students actually did in those three groups. Obviously, well, we split them up according to this, so obviously there are differences across the four groups. But then what we did is we looked at how well they thought they did based on their judgments of how well they knew the course material, that's the red line, and how well they thought they did on the specific test, that's the dotted yellow line. And this graph actually has three main findings I want to talk about. The first is, under a percentile scoring system, average is 50. If you take a look, on average, students are saying they're doing way above average in terms of this test. That's not a finding. On average, you name it, people tend to say that they're above average in it. Leadership, they're above average in it. Driving ability, they're above average in it. Ethics, they're above average in it. Health, they're above average in it. And so forth. That's not a finding. Second, and it's hard to believe, this actually is a real relationship between how well people perceive themselves and how well they're actually doing. It's shallow, but it's statistically there. But that's not a surprise. That's what you always get in studies like this. What I want to focus in on is the thing that's come to be known as the Dunning-Kruger effect, which is these bottom 25% of people. Now, they're at the bottom. They're scoring in about the 11th to the 13th percentile. But they think they have just scored around the 60th and the 65th percentile. They seem to have very little insight into how poorly they've actually done. And we've done this type of study in a lot of different ways, college debate teams, measuring people's sense of humor, their emotional intelligence, their grammar skills, how popular they are, and so forth. And basically what we tend to find is people who are at the bottom tend to wildly overestimate how well they think they're doing. They're not as confident or as positive as people on the top, but they're almost there. And sometimes we see that they are there under various circumstances. And I don't know, for some reason, this was an interesting finding to a lot of people, so it became popular in a lot of different venues in the public. And around 2005, it started to be named the Dunning-Kruger effect. And I just want to make one point about the name of the Dunning-Kruger effect, which is neither Dunning nor Kruger named it that. It was named that in the internet. Which, if there are any graduate students in the audience, this is a cautionary tale. If you don't name your effect, they will name it after you. And so be very careful about what you leave unnamed. Because Justin and I are tickled pink about the fact that our names are going to be associated with bad performance, incompetence, stupidity, ignorance, naivete, gullibility, and the like, probably until after we've sloughed this mortal coil, if you will. And just to give you a few other examples of this, this actually comes from a different set of students. These are medical students down at the University of Florida who are going through an OBGYN clerkship. And this is these are data from about 1,000 medical students going through Shands Hospital, basically, on this rotation for over a 10-year period. And basically what you find there is you pretty much find the same effect in terms of their grades versus the grades they think they're getting on the exam or the grade they think they're getting on the clerkship. That is, the students who are going to get a D-plus in this clerkship the day before they get their grades think they're going to get a B-plus on average, for example. They don't seem to have much of an intuition of just how poorly they're doing. And I would argue something further, they're not in a position to know that they're doing poorly for various reasons. It would actually require B-plus expertise to recognize that I am a D-plus student, for example. If I don't have it, I'm not going to be able to know that I know it. This is another study we did in upstate New York. We invaded a trap and skeet shooting competition in the greater Tompkins County area and gave everybody a quiz on firearm care and safety designed by the NRA. And this is one of the few times where we get the people who did the worst on the quiz actually thinking they did the best on the quiz. That occasionally holds up. And just in case you think people aren't taking it seriously, we've done a study where we asked people to rate their logical reasoning. For half the group, that's all we did. For the other half, we offered to give them up to $100 if they gave us accurate estimates of how many items on this logical reasoning quiz did they get right or how they fit relative to other Cornell students on this quiz. And basically, what you're seeing there are the results of the control group. This is what the impact of offering up to $100 does to people's accuracy. It basically does nothing to people's accuracy whatsoever. It does get their attention. I've never seen such attentive subjects in my life. It just doesn't create accuracy afterward. That is, as far as we know, and we've plumbed very hard, people who are doing poorly seem to be, quite honestly, think that they're doing quite well. And needless to say, this is, at the very least, somewhat of a glitch in knowing yourself. That is, that when you're a poor performer, when you lack expertise, it isn't the case that you're necessarily going to be able to recognize the fact. You will lack the expertise necessary to be able to know that you lack expertise. And this is a problem of attaining the Greek ideal of knowing ourselves. We often don't know when we step into that pocket of incompetence. That'll make it hard for us to know that we are now stepping into that pocket. Now, why is this, and what can we do about it? Let me give you sort of two major reasons why our incompetence or our lack of expertise is invisible to us and has to be invisible to us, and then talk about what are stances we can take when it comes time to make decisions or to answer questions. What are stances we can take to try to make ourselves a little bit more accurate in terms of what we decide, or more accurate in knowing when we know something versus when we need to turn around and ask someone for advice, for example. Well, in talking about why don't people who lack expertise recognize that they lack expertise, I do have to turn to Donald Rumsfeld. And so, many of you know this. He got a lot of flack for this when he once noted that he was talking about issues and problems with terrorism. And he said, basically, and it comes across as very poetic, and by the way, I think it is very poetic, but it also, I think, turns out to be, if you strip everything away, actually quite insightful, which is, well, there are known knowns. There are things we know about terrorist threats that we know. There are known unknowns, that is to say, there are things we know we don't know, but there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we don't know we don't know. And if one looks throughout the history of our country and other free countries, it is this latter category that tends to be the difficult ones. Not only true for terrorism and managing the risks of terrorism, but also knowing yourself. There are obviously things we know, and things we know we could learn a little bit more about. What's invisible to us are all those questions we should be asking, but we don't ask them because they're unknown unknowns. We don't know that they exist. There are questions not asked, clues not looked for, risks not considered, solutions not thought of. And this pervades everything in terms of our ability to address the little summits or problems that we face in everyday life. And I can give you an example of this from our own work. How many of you know the word game Boggle? Just out of curiosity. Okay, some of you know it. What Boggle is you're given an array of 16 letters, something like that. And what you are asked to do is to go through those letters and find, are there letters that you can chain together to form words, for example. And I've done, so here, let's imagine that I get this Boggle set of letters. And let me illustrate for you three words I was able to find. Took me a little while, but I was able to find them. There's Q, C-U-E. There's ACT, A-C-T. There's road, R-O-A-D, and so forth. And what we did in one study is we asked Cornell students basically to go through a number of Boggle sets and then tell us how they thought they were doing, pure and simple. Oh, any guesses as to how many words there are in this puzzle? English words? Has to be at least three letters, I believe. What, 10, 30, 50? Any guesses? Got 20, I've heard 100. Okay, well, actually, to tell you the truth, and this is why we're in the realm of unknown unknowns, there are 259, including redacted, deciders, co-edited, and aeroduct. Now, you might go, okay, if you give me 100 years, I will find those words, and it may be the case that you do. But I'm doubting you're going to find the word acerus, which is a needle-shaped object, dacite, which is a light gray rock, or an ored, which is a mountain nymph from Greek mythology. That is, there are a number of words there that, you know, we don't know that we're missing. So we don't know that they exist. And that is the realm of unknown unknowns, if you will. And part of the reason why we may not necessarily know when we're acting in an inexpert way is because there are solutions, there are approaches we can take, we just don't know of them. They're just completely unaware of them. So naturally, we're not going to be in a position to know how well we're doing when we have so much that is basically lies in the invisible, well beyond our competence, if you will, lies well beyond our expertise. Now, in the terms of word games, Stefan Fatsis, the American journalist, knew this quite well. He once wrote a book called Word Freak about professional Scrabble players. And he made the observation that, in a way, the living room player is lucky. He or she has no idea how miserably he or she fails with almost every turn, how many possible words for optimal plays slip by unnoticed. The idea of Scrabble greatness does not exist for them, if you will. And that's a major problem that we have in terms of being able to judge ourselves. We just aren't privy to our own unknown unknowns. Now, I'm sure there's a lot more incredibly profound things I could say at this moment. I just don't know what they are. That's one problem, but no, that's going to create a problem for knowing yourself, and in particular, knowing your expertise, when so much may lie beyond that which one knows. But that's not the only problem. The other problem that may render our lack of expertise invisible is that often it is veiled or it is clothed by something that quite profoundly hides our inexpertness from us. And I can maybe demonstrate that as well by showing you, well, I'll just talk about one study we did wrapped around the 2014 midterm election where, what I have here are four statements, of two of which are congenial to liberals, two of which are, if you say yes, are congenial to conservatives, two of which are true circa 2014, two of which are false circa 2014. And basically what we did the day after the 2014 election is we just did a massive survey where we asked people if they had voted. We asked them about their politics. And then we asked them, well, do you think this is true or false, or you don't know? And basically people went through about 16 of these statements and answered whether they thought that these statements were true or false or they didn't know. And what we found was the following, which may or may not surprise you. But if we, for example, just take a look at facts that are congenial to conservatives, basically what we found is you're not going to be surprised that conservatives were more likely to endorse those facts than liberals were. What's interesting is the following. Those are the facts that are actually true. These are the facts that are actually false. That is, 40% of what conservatives endorse as true actually turned out to be false. Now let's take a look at liberal facts. You get the flip. Liberals are more likely to endorse liberal facts as true than conservatives are, but roughly 40% of what liberals endorse tend to be, as true, turns out to be false. That is, part of the problem with our expertise or our knowledge of the world is that we know a lot of things that are true, and in fact, it's astonishing what we know that's true. The number of words you know, if you're nearing 60 and you're a native English speaker, you know on average 48,000 words. That's astonishing. Out of context, you can recognize hundreds, almost a thousand people's faces just out of the blue. You just know who they are. At least you've seen them before. You probably have lots of card tricks that you know. You probably know the odds of poker better than I do. There's just a lot of real-world stuff that you know. But here's the problem. Within all that real-world stuff that you know is stuff that you know. It just happens to be false. Most Americans, for example, still believe that we only use 10% of our brains. I'm sorry, the organ is a little bit too oxygen-rich and calorific to be such a luxury to be inert, if you will. I hate to say this to Popeye, but spinach is not a good source of iron. And it is the case that a lot of Americans believe that on an average year, we accidentally ingest 8 to 10 spiders while we sleep. It turns out to be false. Both we and spiders have defense mechanisms against that. But the problem with our massive, I mean, this organic hard drive we've got in our head, the squishy, squishy hard drive, it just contains astonishing knowledge. Such astonishing knowledge that a lot of it just happens to be untrue. But this is the problem. Untruth often has the look and the feel of truth. And as such, it hides from us the fact that we may not know as much as we think we may know. And I'm going to wave my hands a lot in the next 30 seconds. But basically, what I can do with the data that I just showed you is basically show you that people will understand that they're not well informed if and when they can come up with no answer to a question. So has the poverty rate under Obama gone up or gone down? I don't know. Well, it turns out that if you ask people 16 questions, and when they get something right, yay, but when they get something wrong, all they do is say, I don't know. What you get is a nice correlation between how much they know that's right and how well-informed they think they are as a U.S. citizen and as a U.S. voter. And this considers only those situations where either you're right or you say, I don't know. Now, let's talk about a different situation that when you don't come up with the right answer, you come up with an answer that just happens to be wrong every time. You don't say, I don't know. You have some idea that you've been able to create from your brain that this answer I know, it just happens to be a wrong answer. What happens is you basically get a much flatter relationship between how much a person really knows and what they think about how well-informed a voter or how well-informed a citizen they are. That is part of the problem that causes us not to know our lack of expertise is we have actively wrong answers in our head that sort of veil the fact that we really don't know the right answer. Wrong answers tend to have the same look and feel, the same smell as right answers, and so they can trick us into thinking that we're expert when in fact we're not expert. Well, what do we do about that? Especially when we live in these times. If you've taken a look at the last year, basically what's happened is people are asking, is truth dead? Does truth matter? Can you really believe the news that you're getting? Especially if you're on, for example, a Twitter feed where in one half hour you're told that coffee can make you live longer, the next half hour your Twitter feed from Time Magazine, both ways, is telling you that coffee causes cancer. Okay, what do you do when the world is pushing veils on you of misinformation and so forth? I'm going to skip something that's illustrative. We may get back to it, but here's a few of the things that we can do, especially to make sure to guard against falling prey to misbeliefs, which will hide from the fact that from us that they are misbeliefs. The first is whatever you do, don't jump to conclusions. The slides I just went past are actually inspired by schizophrenia research showing that among schizophrenia patients, only some schizophrenia patients are going to fall prey to their delusions. Other schizophrenia patients will have delusions, but they'll know them to be delusions. They'll remain lucid. And the question becomes, what separates the first group from the second group? And what separates the first group is that when you give them cognitive puzzles that have nothing to do with the real world and nothing to do with schizophrenia and nothing to do with anything emotional, they just jump to conclusions. They know the answer immediately. Or they know the answer after only a scant little slice of evidence. Those are the people who tend to fall prey to delusions when they're suffering from schizophrenia. Schizophrenia patients who hold on and wait before they make a call, they wait for more evidence, they think about it a little bit more, tend to remain more lucid in the face of delusions. What we've done is a lot of work showing the same sort of thing happens in the general population. If you want to take a look in the general population about who falls a prey to conspiracy theories, falls a prey to misbeliefs in terms of medical care, who makes more types of reasoning errors, it's those who jump to conclusions rather than those who wait before they jump to conclusions. So one major theme to suggest is if you want to make sure that you're reaching a right decision and not buying into a misbelief is don't jump to conclusions. But beyond that, if you're a psychologist, what you would recommend is, well, by the way, while you're thinking, here are some things you might try in terms of thinking that might guard against buying into misbeliefs that might be very tempting, but that turn out to be false. The first is whenever you're thinking through a decision, do consider alternatives to what might be the most likely outcome or the most likely decision. That is, should I invest in this stock or not? Is this person on the phone trying to sell me this financial instrument? Should I really go with it or not? Well, let me consider all the other alternative investments that I might make and how it stacks up against those alternatives and what I know about those alternatives. That is, don't consider only the hypothesis or the outcome in front of you. Think of alternatives. For doctors, this is known as differential diagnosis. That is, if a patient comes in with a malady, don't generate a hypothesis and diagnose yes or no, do they have that? But rather consider all the possible sicknesses, illnesses, maladies that may fit those symptoms and then ask, what information do I need to get further to help me differentiate this possibility from this possibility from this other possibility? That is, think of all the possibilities and ask, what information can I get that's going to help me differentiate which is the alternative or the possibility that's most likely to be the wise one to select, for example. That's number one. Number two, this is a favorite among psychologists. If you think X, great. Now think of why not X might happen. If you think Hillary Clinton's going to win the 2016 presidential election, stop. Think how it might be the case that Trump may win the 2016 presidential election. Imagine if a lot of people had actually done that, they might have been able to predict what happened that Tuesday night. By the way, a way that you can do this, which actually is a very interesting exercise, is let's say that you're considering doing a project, and you want to know how long will it take the project, how much effort will it take the project, how much money will it take the project, but you know about this overconfidence thing. What might you do to guard against that overconfidence? Well, do this. Transport yourself into a future world where you've done the project, and it was a complete and utter disaster. Now, what went wrong? This is called doing a pre-mortem. That is, don't wait for your project to die. Try to figure out, go project yourself into the future and ask, if my project had died, what went wrong? I've actually done it for this talk, believe it or not. Before this talk, I sat down and said, okay, if this talk is a disaster, what have I done to create a disaster? And so far as I know, I haven't done any of those things. It may still be a disaster, by the way. I'm not going to discount that. But at least I haven't done the things I could have done, I usually will have done, to make this thing just be an awful, awful talk. So it's a, I won't say it's above average. But in considering the decisions you make and considering the judgments you make, be sure to separate what psychologists refer to as the strength of the evidence from its weight. Now, that's technical talk. What do I mean by that? Usually, when people gather evidence for some sort of decision they might have in the future, what they look to see is how strong is that evidence? Does it really, really suggest a conclusion? Like, you just heard about this poll when you were walking over here that suggested that Trump's approval rating is now 70%. Whoa, it's really gone up. Wow. Okay, that's the strength of the signal. It's a strong signal that Trump's approval rating has gone up. That is different from its weight, which is how credible is the source of the information. Is it something that you should believe? Like, okay, his approval rating is 70%. Should I believe that? How many people did they survey? 10. I'd be less likely to believe it than if they had surveyed 1,000 people, for example. That goes to weight. Or it comes from a fourth grade science project done over in Pinckney as opposed to, Pew Research Center, for example. Was this done by expert poll takers or was this done by people who may, for lack of a better term, are not as reputable in terms of their track record? That is, what people tend to do is not consider weight as much as they should. They don't back up and ask, how credible is this information? It may be a strong signal. I should sell my stock. Trump is doing better. It's going to be warm in Ann Arbor tomorrow. But you also, when it's important, figure out whether or not there's enough weight to support what might be a strong message. But more generally, what people could potentially do is, well, the Dunning-Kruger effect suggests that people who are incompetent are not in a position to know they're incompetent. We aren't in a position to know what we don't know. So one easy way, conceptually, to get rid of the Dunning-Kruger effect is to get competent, is to consider learning and making learning a continuing effort that we all do. To the extent we become better informed, we're less likely to fall prey to the Dunning-Kruger effect. But as well, for those concerned about the Dunning-Kruger effect, especially those who are young, I would basically suggest the following four things that turn out to be important whenever one is in a position where you might have to deal with overconfidence, which is number one, get mentors. if one major problem is there are unknown unknowns out there that we don't even know we should be asking about, mentors, people who've been there, done that, often are in a great position to let us know about unknown unknowns we've never heard of, for example. The Chinese sailing, you know, to know the way ahead, ask someone who's coming back from the road. There's tremendous wisdom in that saying in terms of if you want to know about unknown unknowns, get people who have some sort of experience. Second, beware of new situations. Those tend to be the situations that bite us in terms of we think we know what's going on, but we don't know what's going on. Now, I came here to Ann Arbor a couple years ago after 29 years in Ithaca, New York, and I was beware of the new. I always had my GPS on every single moment I stepped out of my condo to travel around Ann Arbor because I was worried about just how easy it is for me to get lost. And by the way, it's very easy for me to get lost. One could argue that I was lost in Ithaca, New York for 29 years, and that was a majority true. That is, if you're stepping into a new situation, as opposed to one you're familiar with, do try to make sure that you get advice. Economic research supports this, namely entrepreneurs who are just simply creating a new company and a business they're familiar with, they've been in before, tend to do quite nicely. It's when entrepreneurs change industries that they get themselves into trouble and fail. And 86% of businesses, new businesses, tend to fail within 3 years. So beware of the new, if you will. And one of the things that you can do is, if you're worried about overconfidence, is to apply something referred to as cognitive buffers, which is essentially put in a margin of safety in whatever you do. So for the first year that I was in Ann Arbor, if I had to go from point A to point B, I'd look up how many minutes it took to drive there. Number one, I'm wary of the new. But then I'd add 15 minutes because sooner or later I was going to get lost or something was going to happen. So I would just arbitrarily add 15 minutes to make sure that I would get there on time, if you will. I'd start 15 minutes early. Smart businesses know this. Microsoft, when it comes time to develop new apps or new features in its software, will ask its designers how long will it take to develop. They'll listen to what the designers say. They'll believe in what the designers say. And then they'll multiply that time by 30% just to make sure. 50% of its operating system relevant. Architects will calculate how much concrete they need to make a building stable. And then just once they get that number, they'll multiply it by up to 8 times to make sure the building is really going to be stable. That's because they know there are unknown unknowns out there. But by definition, they know they don't know when those unknown unknowns are going to crop up and bite them. So as a consequence, they just adopt a stance of having cognitive buffers, if you will. And finally, if you want to anticipate the future, the one advantage you have is the past. Often, if you want to predict what's going to happen to you, how long a project is going to take, whether or not you're going to succeed in X, collect data from your experience and other people's past experiences. Often what's happened to other people is a really terrific indicator of what's going to happen to you. The situation turns out to be more special than you are. So if you want to figure out what will happen to you in a situation, find out about the situation by getting people's experiences in the past. I am going to bring this in under time. I started us in Nepal, but let me end by taking us to the past, and in particular to the 1970s, when I watched a lot of television, especially in the daytime. There wasn't much to do in my small little town, and so I would watch a lot of Let's Make a Deal. I don't know how many of you ever watched Let's Make a Deal. Exactly. You got it right, except no costume. People would basically dress up in costumes, and Monty Hall would basically ask people, try to make deals with people and so forth, and he might do something like this, which is he's got 3 doors on the stage in front of him, and behind one of the doors is a brand new car. Can you select which door the car is behind? You've got a 1 in 3 chance. So, well, you, not knowing, can only choose randomly, so you choose door number 3, and then Monty Hall does something interesting. He shows you what's behind door number 1, and it's a goat. So the car is either behind door number two or door number three. And he asks you this simple question. Do you want to stay with door number three or do you want to switch? Now here's the thing. Life is a lot like a game show, except it's a little bit more complicated. You don't know what the rules are. Contestants keep changing. The rules keep changing. There aren't any commercial breaks where you can take a break. But other than that, life is a game show. And you win at the game show if you're able to make many more right decisions than you are wrong decisions. And everybody's going to make wrong decisions. Everybody's going to make mistakes. But can you up the percentage of right decisions you make and lower the percentage of right decisions you make and lower the percentage of mistakes that you can make? Now, you're sitting there, you really want that car, you feel like maybe you should stay, but the guy who's dressed as the Turtle Wax bottle next to you is screaming into your ear that you should switch. Monty Hall smiling at you devilishly, okay, you got that, but what do you do? Well, that's a lot like life. And if you can choose the right decision, things will be incrementally better. That's the first thing to mention. The second thing to mention is if you've been listening behind what I've been talking about today, is that every decision and every judgment actually is two judgments. There is the judgment or the decision you make, but there is another judgment implicit in that which accompanies every judgment, which is how sure are you? Do you know what you're about? Do you really not know? Are you certain? Should you seek advice? Should you be cautious? Should you go straight ahead because that's the way to really profit from this? Behind every decision is a decision that might be more important, which is how certain are you or how confident are you? That's the decision, in some sense, that the Greeks were talking about when they talked about know yourself. Can you properly apply certainty and doubt to the decisions, the moves, the tactics, the strategies that you apply to life? Now, that's one comment I would make, but you find a version of it in the sayings of Anatole France, French poet and journalist, when he said that an education isn't how much you've committed to memory or even how much you know. It's being able to differentiate between what you know and what you don't. I'd say that that not only is an education, but it is potentially a lot more as well. Let me stop there to see if there are any questions.
So in the difference between self-evaluation by and evaluation by a peer or like a mentor, but would that apply to in a family, like a person doesn't really know themselves and can't predict what they'll be doing, but their parent can?
Well, certainly my parents could. At least that was my my experience. It is the case that in the data that have been collected so far, and these are where questions are asked like, will this romantic couple, these are a couple of college students who are together, will they stay together for the next 6 months? It does turn out that parents do know better than kids, for example. And by the way, the roommate knows better as well, it turns out. That is, one of the things we haven't talked about is the fact that part of the problem with self-prediction and self-perception is there are certain conclusions we want to happen, have happen. Like we would like this romance to stay together. I should like to get that grant that I'm submitting and so forth. And it is the case that the wishful thinking does bend our thinking much more than it will a third person who just isn't falling prey to that, just isn't susceptible to that. And so there are instances in which sometimes we do know ourselves better than third parties. But if we're talking about a situation where there's a lot of ego or a lot of wish fulfillment involved, I'd go with the third party, especially if they're knowledgeable. They've been around. And they know your situation, they've lived life, and they know who you are. They're in a better position, in particular because they're predictions aren't being swayed by rose-colored glasses, essentially. So beyond that, sometimes it depends on the parent, sometimes it depends on the kid.
But what I wanted to ask is, in those studies, you were basically asking people to predict two things, or assess two things, one, their own performance, and one, the mean, the average of the group. Can you talk a little bit about how good we are at assessing that? Because I would have told you that everyone in that group did really poorly, but maybe just the group did really well, and I did as well as I thought I was, but my own relative performance is off.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Thank you for it. Now, we tend to focus it on the comparative question, how well did you do relative to others? Because first, we're social psychologists, and we're interested in how people think they stack up relative to other people. But often in life, that's the important question. It's not you per se. It's how you perform relative to other people. What we haven't featured in this work, but we have talked about, is if we just ask people about themselves, like how well did you do on this exam? How many items did you get right? We get people at the bottom wildly overestimating how well they've done, essentially. So they seem to be falling prey to not really having any much insight into how poorly they themselves are doing. Now, one of the things I haven't featured, by the way, in the talk is what's going on for people at the top. Because if you notice the original graph, this is the fourth finding, the people at the top are underestimating themselves a little bit. Now, that's only true for the comparative question. That is, the problem for people at the top is they have themselves right. And if you ask them how many did you get right, they nail it pretty much. Or we can't find any bias. But if it's easy for me, it must be easy for other people, so they end up overestimating everybody else. And so they're modest, not because they're wrong about themselves, but they're the ones who are wrong about other people. They think, if I know it, everybody else has to know it too. And now, mind you, the people at the bottom are saying, oh, I know it, everybody else knows it as well. So their problem is they don't know how poorly they're doing. They just don't recognize their mistakes as mistakes. They just think they're the right answers. But it's the people at the top who suffer this burden of not knowing how special they are in some respects. Now, when I would teach a summer course at Cornell, and that was the one time I could hire undergraduates as teaching assistants for my courses, and I would hire the best undergraduate possible. And about 2 weeks into the course, I would have uniformly every summer what I became to call the conversation. And the conversation was this. Oh, it happened right after the first exam was given in the class. The really good student is now grading these exams. After about a half an hour, they run into my office and say, Professor Dunning, I can't believe it. I mean, their exams are horrible. They don't know the answer. They're BSing like mad. Their penmanship is bad, and they can't even write a complete sentence. I can't believe students can be this bad. And my response is, yes, students can be that bad. You are that special. Now, don't get a big head. So there are some people who have problems in their estimates of other people, and it turns out the people who are at the very top, they think everybody else is up there as well. By the way, people at the top, this is current research we have ongoing, also have another burden, which is this is sort of the flip or the Dunning-Kruger effect inside out, which is they're so competent, no one else has the competence to recognize just how competent they are. So people who are really, really good, geniuses, virtuosos, literally hide in plain sight because on average people don't recognize how good they really are, how much insight or how much wisdom they have in what they have to say, or what their suggestions are. So that's work we currently have ongoing. But what we've been able to do is establish that for people who are performing poorly, it's just they can't recognize mistakes, and they don't have the expertise to be able to do so. But people in the top are living in a different misapprehension, and that's about the people that they're surrounded by. So, but good question. And you did fine, by the way, on the exam.
Yes, I was thinking, but there's also some great benefits to being overly self-confident about yourself. You try and do a lot of things that you probably would, if you really knew how poor you were, you probably wouldn't even try them.
Well, I think that's right. It's a little complicated, but, well, I mean, for example, I've known a lot of people who live through their 20s desperately trying to break into music or break into acting, and they have great stories to tell, and maybe they were delayed by the time they went to graduate school, but they were able to have a lot of experience that other people weren't able to have. That is, there wasn't much of a downside, if you will, on at least trying, or at least being too overly optimistic, if you will. But if you're talking about other situations, though, there are circumstances where being overly certain is helpful. But it's better, actually, if you have a switch where you can switch from being overly certain to being overly uncertain. And let me give you an example. On the day my troops are going into battle, and I'm a general, I want to be the most inspiring, confident, certain, bedrock commander I can be. The reason being is we have a plan. If people confidently execute the plan, fewer people will die. And if I'm a doctor, I have a regimen I want my patient to follow. I might be wrong, but odds are this patient will benefit if they follow my regimen. Okay. But I don't want, until that day, I don't want that general and I don't want that doctor to be overconfident. I want them to switch and now become the most paranoid, worrisome, pessimistic people possible so that they can, let's take the case of the general, make sure they have enough ordnance, make sure they have enough troops, make sure they have enough plans because plan A may not work and I better be able to swiftly be able to move into a plan B if there's some unknown unknowns in the foxholes that that I don't know about that that happened when we hit that island. So I want a general that over-prepares like mad in uncertainty, and then we'll flip on the switch and be the inspiring person the day that it's time to go and actually execute the battle. Same with the doctor. I want the doctor to sweat out the differential diagnosis. And then once they've sweated that out, convince me that they have a regimen that I want to follow. Another way to put this is that one of the things I mentioned is that like 86% of businesses fail within, I said 3 years, it's actually five, I apologize. 86% of new businesses fail within 5 years. And you could say, well, okay, 86% fail, but those 14% that survive really benefit society. So we benefit from all this overconfidence. And that may be true, but I often think of what if among those 86%, people were a little bit more cautious, they capitalized a little bit more, so they had some more money on the side. They weren't so optimistic about when they were going to profit or when they were going to turn a profit, so that their businesses would have survived, and we could have profited even more by even more successful businesses that are out there. I don't know how many great ideas, for example, just got killed, not because they were bad ideas, but because they were undercapitalized ideas. The person simply didn't back them enough with enough capital to make sure they could get to a break-even point. So the relationship between overconfidence, underconfidence, and what you want to have happen in the world is a somewhat complicated one. It also suggests that what you want to do is know that confidence is something that you want to manage. Some days you really want to be confident because it's going to create benefits, but you have to know when to switch it off because it's what it's going to do to benefits is just place them further away. So you're absolutely right, but if you look at a lot of different circumstances in life, it turns out underconfidence to overconfidence is something that you want to manage. By the way, if you really look at it, that's really what Steve Jobs was. He wasn't overconfident. His products were never going to be slick enough, inexpensive enough, simple enough, minimalist enough, cool enough. Beat on his engineers, but on the day they were unfurled, they were an inflection point upon Western civilization. So sort of if you look at the Steve Jobs example, I think you sort of what I see is what I'm suggesting, essentially.
Well, yes, I agree with you there, but I think there's some other situations where it does help to be overconfident about yourself, because if you're not, you're going to be, you feel really bad about yourself and depressed about yourself. So being depressed, well, you may be more accurate, but that's not going to really get you much.
That's true, but you have to balance that, and this goes back to this issue of confidence being managed, with being overconfident in such a way that you actually put yourself in a situation that might be a situation of despair, if you will. That is, because of overconfidence, you don't do as well as you could have with a little bit more caution. So it's something you have to balance, something you really do have to do think about. What I'm suggesting is underconfidence isn't a panacea and overconfidence isn't a panacea.
A school like Cornell tends to be populated with students that are already in the top quarter,
right?
Say, what effect does that have on the shape of your curve if you did it with a broader population, or you took let's say the top 25% of the students at Cornell, and then had them take the test and ask them the same question, would that affect your results?
Well, I don't know about the last part of your question, but the answer to what it does to the shape of the curve is it does nothing, it turns out. That is, you have to remember that, well, students at elite universities are chosen because of the complete package of who they are. So some of them are very likely to have some severe deficits. It might be math, it might be verbal, it might be time management, it might be any number of things, so that you can find an adequate number of people who really truly are bad at X. Or at least even at Cornell, we found a lot of people who were truly bad at X often. And we've also gone to different populations like this election survey I just mentioned, where we're pretty much getting people from the general population. And what we're getting is the same curve, essentially. So I see the worry, absolutely. And we were worried enough about it to worry about it and collect data to make sure that that drawing people only from Cornell wasn't producing the results artifactually. Well, and including, by the way, one of the original studies we did was on sense of humor. And part of the reason why we did that study on sense of humor is we knew that Cornell students were chosen based on verbal and math skill and intellectual skill. We knew with certainty that Cornell students were not chosen based on their sense of humor. And you can trust me on that one. And that's actually where we got our strongest effects in a little bit. But we've looked at elite populations and non-elite populations, and we pretty much get the same thing, essentially. It's surprising how little it matters.
I was just wondering, how does intuition interplay with self-knowledge? And we really didn't discuss that tonight.
Because that's an entirely different hour that I'm going to give you an answer, and it's going to be oversimplified, so I flag it as such, which is that it depends on where the intuition comes from. Because if you note, part of the talk, I was basically suggesting implicitly beware intuition. You know, don't go with your gut. Hold back and think alternatives, blah, 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 and so forth. And if you take a look at the overconfidence literature, that's what the overconfidence literature is going to suggest. The reason being, because if you just go with intuition, you consider one hypothesis. You don't consider any other hypothesis. That just sets you up to be overconfident if something else turns out to be true. But if you start to think about alternatives, now by definition, you have multiple hypotheses that you can consider, and that may help to come to a right decision or figure out where your doubt may lay, for example. Now, here's where the literature hasn't delved enough, I think, to give a clear answer. But it is the case that as you become a true expert, and this is key, you have to be a true expert at something, intuition becomes your friend, if you will, because a hallmark of an expert is you don't have to think about it, you just know. And to give everybody an example of what I'm talking about, because we're all experts in this, it's face recognition is the one thing that we're all pretty much experts on. That is, you go and you look at someone you know, and you know, just know they're there. You know, you don't have to think your way into who is that on television. I don't know. Okay, very manly-looking, older, looks like an 80s movie star, Schwarzenegger. That's not how you do face recognition, right? It's just like that. And that's because face recognition is something that we overlearn, we become true experts at. And there are some things that we become overly expert at. One of the things I have to confess to my colleagues is I do a lot of reviewing of papers, scientific papers, and often I just want to go, no. I just don't want to bother with saying why. I just know this, no. I don't know if you've ever had that. At some point, you just kind of go, yes or no. But that's a hallmark of true expertise. Now, here's the catch. What I've suggested is you've got to be very wary about whether or not you're a true expert. And if you can verify that you're a true expert, then I think you can live quite nicely more in the realm of intuition. If you're not an expert, And the situation is important enough because we are talking about expending effort, and effort is crucial. Effort is calories we could be doing other things with. Time we could be doing other things with. If the situation is important enough, it may be worthwhile to say, that's nice intuition, thank you for that response, now let me think of alternatives. But I have just really oversimplified things. Yeah. I'll give put that in as a footnote.
I realize that your studies were all done in the U.S., and I wonder, in the level of overconfidence, are there differences across the world? Do you think that the study is representative of the world as a whole, or are there cultural differences, geographic differences, anything like that?
Oh, funny you should ask that. this is a current project we have going on. Where we're taking advantage of the fact that 8th graders around the world every 4 years, about 500,000 8th graders in 50 different countries, are tested on their math and science skills. So we basically have their math and science skill performance on the same test across the world. And they've been asked how confident they are in their math and science skill. Now, these are two countries who I won't identify. For those of you who know the identification numbers, you can figure out what they are. But what I'm going to do is highlight for you the section of the graph showing kids who are really doing at a low level of math skill, but they think positively of their math skill. And in these two countries, what you see is actually over half the people performing at a low level think they have positive math skill. So, I'm going to call that Dunning-Kruger. We'll see if the reviewers accept that idea. But that's these two countries. Now, let's take a look at two other countries who I will identify. That's Japan and that's Korea. And if you take a look at the same box, what you find is practically no one in that box. That is, you find nobody who's performing poorly saying that they have thinking positively of their math skill. And there seem to be two things that are going on. One is these kids are doing a lot better in math, so they escape that way. But the other thing that we've been able to find in our data is, okay, what's the trick in Korea or Japan or countries like them? Which, by the way, for those of you who know cultural psychology, these are long-term oriented countries. These are countries that are worried about the future, improving for the future, investing for the future. They discount the present, as opposed to short-term oriented countries, which are all about celebrating the now. And you can imagine where the United States is on this. But there is one thing piece of behavior we found in long-term oriented countries that suggests a cultural difference, but we can still hold on to the idea that people who are incompetent are not in a position to know they're incompetent. What's different about these countries is your teachers are willing to tell you you're bad.
Hi, thanks, Professor. Unless I misunderstand the concept, the lack of expertise in terms of having the bias, is it's more of not being aware of your lack of expertise rather than just lack of expertise per se. In other words, my thoughts on this are that it has more to do with ego issues with threats to a sense of cohesion or sense of self that you have difficulty with the accuracy, and so there's a whole realm there, and it's more about one's ability, regardless of their expertise, in terms of self-awareness, in terms of being able to confront their own ego and be comfortable with not knowing things. That's kind of the issue?
Yes, and the one thing to tell you is that I'm not going to deny that there's wishful thinking, defensive thinking, a denial, and so forth. I'm not going to deny denial, for example. What I'm suggesting, though, is even before you get there, you have a problem with lack of expertise. That is, you don't need defensiveness or ego for people who are doing badly to not recognize that they're doing badly. They simply don't have the expertise to recognize that they lack expertise. There is a layer of self-deception that people are prone to, we haven't gotten there yet. That's another hour or two that we could discuss. Well, actually, I'm going to indulge myself if that's okay. Half of what my lab is in the ego world, if you will. What I'm suggesting, everything I've talked about today is not in the ego world. It's not ego defensiveness. It's rather they're not in a position to know. Now, you can add ego to that, and there might be certain characters in popular culture you can imagine, but even if you make people as impartial and non-defensive as possible, you still have all the problems I talked about today. But then you've got this other layer, if I've got this right, with the fact that, yes, your brain is a remarkable artist and a remarkable trickster. And one of the things it doesn't like is it doesn't like things that are inconstant with experience. So people reacted. And your brain is very willing to retouch things, to get things back into what you expect. Now, I don't know how many of you have seen these strawberries lately, but okay, we won't have an argument about this. Just trust me on this one. There are no red pixels on that screen. Zero. Your brain is putting them there. Your brain is seeing the blue light and going, we've got to correct that. We've got to make it more natural. So your brain is taking everyday experience making red strawberries look red. Your brain, by the way, the idea that your brain is telling you what's happening in the world, forget it, not happening. Your brain is one of the most remarkable artists in the world. It has to be or you'd be dead. That's another hour. But what it's doing is it's taking a lot of what you perceive about the world, and I mean literal perception, and moving it toward what you expect or things that are more comfortable, including ego, for example. So I show you this array of faces. These are actually synthetic faces that are obviously been morphed into being more European-centric or Afrocentric in terms of their features. Don't argue with me. This face and that face have exactly the same average and variance in skin tone. But your brain has certain expectations, and as a consequence, it's changing what skin tone it thinks you're seeing. So now, this might help. If I flip the faces, things might look more similar to you because it disconnects. I've disconnected the stimulus with your experience, if you will. So, okay, we talked about not knowing yourself. We didn't talk about what your brain is doing in terms of ego defense. It is the case that your brain sometimes indulges you, if you will. And this was shown in an experiment. We just wanted to see if what you want literally does change what you see. And so these are some data we published 5 years ago, where what we did is we put people in the laboratory and basically told them the computer was either going to show them letters or numbers in series. And for half the people, they were told every time you see a number, congratulations, you get lottery tickets. And when you get letters, we'll take lottery tickets away. The other half were told the opposite, that if you saw letters, you would get lottery tickets. But when you got numbers, we'd take lottery tickets away. Now, here's the setup. 3D glasses, they're designed such that this is what we're actually showing people. And what your brain is going to do, what that does is that separates which image which eye gets. This setup will cause your left eye to see the 4 and your right eye to see the H. What your brain will do is it won't push those images together, it'll choose one to present to the theater of consciousness. This is called binocular rivalry. Present something here that's coherent, something here that's coherent, your brain will choose one. The question is, which one does the brain tend to choose in this situation where you could be winning lottery tickets or losing lottery tickets? This is what people report seeing. When lottery tickets, you got lottery tickets when you, I want to make sure I get this right, when you saw letters, what happened is that people saw more letters, or rather their brain picked more letters for them to see across the 6 trials or 6 examples that we showed people. That is, they know what they report doesn't have any influence about how much money they're getting. They're told that what they have to do is report accurately on what they're seeing. But their brain is playing favorites, and if you're going to win lottery tickets if you see letters, that's what the brain tends to report that you see. If numbers are going to get you lottery tickets, that's what the brain reports that it's seeing more often than not. So what often is happening, so I'm not going to dismiss a lot of ego defensiveness, a lot of indulgence, if you will, or wishful thinking to the world. That's half of the work in my lab. What I want to suggest is even if you strip that all away, you still got this cold, expertise informational world with its own problems that prevents people from seeing how poorly they're doing. So it's not that people are being defensive. They honestly may think they're that good. Well, that's what I've learned, essentially.
Did anyone else want to ask Professor Dunning a question? I'll bring you the microphone if anyone would like an opportunity.
Thanks for their presentation. So this explains a lot about when I look back on my performance reviews a little bit less than fondly, right? I mean, that's another hour or something that you have, but in relationship to corporate HR, mm-hmm. employee performance, have you delved into that at all?
I haven't, but there are definite lessons about how you deal with self-assessment, how you deal with feedback in an organizational setting. Because the first thing to start off is we're not very good at giving feedback, we're not very good at receiving feedback, in part because of the defensiveness that, you know, sometimes we feel. I'll just quickly mention three things that if you're going to give feedback, these are three principles to keep in mind in an HR setting. Number one, keep the feedback behavioral, not characterological. By that I mean, talk about what the person is doing or not doing, not about any of their traits or characteristics. Don't make it about them. Make it about their behavior. Number one, that's probably quite common and people know that. Number two is don't make feedback infrequent, because if you make feedback infrequent, it becomes a big event. And big events people get defensive about. Especially if you tie in the infrequent event with the person's supervisor being mad. Because a lot of people hear feedback only when their supervisor is raging mad at them. Not a good situation. So you have to make feedback more regular, more of a minor incident, if you will. And number three, never ever connect it with merit pay. A lot of companies, when it comes time to tell you what your merit pay is going to be for the year, that's when you get the feedback. Merit pay is very self-identifying. Merit pay is something people are concerned about. Merit pay is something that people can be defensive about. So what you want is you want to have feedback that's disconnected from that rather ego-involving event to make sure that people can actually hear. But you're right, it's another hour in terms of how do you give feedback, because there's a half hour on that, which is about giving feedback, and then there's another half hour about receiving feedback, which I think as a culture we could be doing a lot better at. That's just me.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.